Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd. And tonight I will be joined by guest host, co-host Red Beckman and Dr. Kate and Dwayne Moore. And we have our first guest, I believe, that is online with us at this time. Red, I believe you have a live mic as well. Dwayne, you have a live mic. And David Lonier, you have a live mic. We will introduce you in just a moment, David. Okay. Dwayne, are you there?
Yes, I am. It's very good to hear from you.
Red, are you with us?
I'm here.
I'm going to ask
Ready
Dwayne.
Accounted for.
I'm going to ask Dwayne to open us with a prayer.
Well, thank you, Terry. Oh, great King, oh, great Lawgiver, oh, great Merciful Lawgiver, we thank you so much, Father, for the wonderful brilliance you have bestowed upon us from the time of Adam to the time we are in now. And you would think that we've had all this time, we would have brought ourselves to a better understanding and knowledge of perfecting this law that you've delivered to us over the centuries and generations. Father, we ask, Father, that you'll forgive us for not having done a very good job of what you've given us. We ask, Father, that you help us to understand now how to be better stewards of this land, of our servants, and Father, that we might better tarry till you do come, which obviously sure feels like it's right around the corner. Father, give all the right words to Terry, Red, Dr. Kate, myself, and of course our guests, David and Trish, that we might help our buddy Dave, who's in lockup at the moment. We thank you, Father, for your instruction, your will, your power, and the Son of your Son, Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus the Christ. Hallelujah.
Thank you, Dwayne. Well, Red, we didn't get a chance last week to congratulate you on your 60th wedding anniversary, and I want to make sure to make mention of that. How was it last week? I know you had family in, and you're probably resting up now that they're all gone.
Recuperation, you call it.
Uh-huh. Well, let's jump right in with our guest, David Lonier. David, it was a pleasure speaking with you earlier today, and perhaps Dwayne might want to contribute to this introduction. I know that you are retired now, but you're probably working harder than you ever did, trying to save this country as a representative of the Ron Paul campaign and working with We the People, which, you know, Kate and I and Red, we're all at St. Charles back in the fall of 2009 for the Continental Congress, which was sponsored by the We the People group. And this is a very interesting situation that we're faced with now, in that David Scheid, who we met there in St. Charles, I just give us a little bit of history of yourself, David, and then tell the folks a little bit what you know about David Scheid and the character of the man that is being now, in my mind, persecuted as a political prisoner. I'll just give you the floor for a bit here and let you have it.
Okay, yeah, I'm pretty much tuned into the Patriot movement. I've been in it since 1996. And, I've seen what's going on. I probably attended at least 100 court cases. I've had written up paper for other people, and worked with the courts. And it's the more you know, the more you understand, the more you see what's going on, it seems that the you know, the less opportunity we have to exert and exercise our rights and have them protected by the courts. So David's pretty much been involved in the same thing. But he's been a victim's rights advocate for a long time. He was born in Montana and raised in Texas. He spent some time in California. And because of an experience he had, he understood that people need to help other people, particularly people who are in trouble. A lot of times, through no fault of their own, they end up in court or in jail or something to that effect. And he's always been, you know, advocate for the underdog. But he probably takes it to the fullest extent possible, and this is probably might be the reason he's now incarcerated. But I attended the court hearing where he was literally kidnapped. As simply a court observer in a court where the judge happened to be named in one of his lawsuits. And that's pretty much what happened. And we're now attempting to use every means possible to get him released. He will be he will be out July the 2nd. She could only hold him for 30 days if he was cited for contempt. But we don't know. My observation, there was no contempt shown for the court. If anything, it was contempt for David by kidnapping.
Well, kind of describe that scene, if you will.
Yes, it was a we like to get a lot of court observers into the court. So anytime one of our group somebody has an issue or a hearing, this was for a code violation. A fellow put a privacy fence on his property without getting a permit, you know, without applying for the permit. That was the charge. He was charged for not applying for a permit to build a privacy fence on his property, which we know is, you know, it is simply a fundraiser for the city. But anyway, we were observing it. There were four of us, I believe, including David. And they called the case forward, and the judge told the defendant to sit in the jury box, which is very unusual. And so he complied, kind of slowly, kind of asking, you know, why don't I stand where the defendant stands? And, well, anyway, she was barking out orders, and then she told the bailiff to go over and do something. And then, I don't know what she said, but what he did is he walked up to the rail there, which separates the audience from the judge's area, and was pointing at David, saying, stand up, you in the black and white shirt, stand up. And David did stand up, and then the judge yelled, screamed, sit down. And David, I believe, sat down. I didn't see him sit down, but they said he sat down. And then the bailiff told him to stand up again. He stood up, and David has a hearing problem. So anyway, you know, that combined with the judge yelling and screaming, she asked him. She said, "Tell us your name." David, I was sitting there. I watched David. He didn't say a word. He kept his mouth shut. And within, I'd say, 10 seconds, she said, "We need backup." And three other uniform armed police officers came into the courtroom, stood by the side of the aisle, called him out, said, "Come step into the aisle." Took his hands, put them behind his back, handcuffed him, took him off to a room. And then she continued with this court hearing. Prior to that, she asked each one of us to stand up and give our names, and we did. When she asked me my name, I said my name. I gave her the first name, and she said, "Well, tell me your last name." I said, "I will give you my last name under duress, for fear of my safety. And then I gave her my last name. And that basically she said, okay, sit down to each of us. But they took David. He was doing the same thing we were doing. After the hearing, after she issued the order, which was a $150 fine, she said this case is over. And at that point, they took David out of the courtroom into the jail, which is a building adjacent to the courtroom or the courthouse. And then we immediately went over to the jail, talked to the guy at the desk, and he said, well, there will be a hearing, and they will decide what to do with him. Well, so we went back to the courthouse, talked to the clerk, tried to get a transcript. They wouldn't give us transcript. They said it's an informal hearing. We don't have transcripts. We talked to the bailiff a little more, and he said, well, I'll go ask the judge something. He whispered in her ear. She left the courtroom. We sat there for an hour and a half. Some of us had to leave, but some of us stayed, and apparently she never had a hearing. So he's in jail without ever having a hearing or nothing. No hearing, no case number, no sentencing, no transcript, no video, no witnesses.
Now, what is subsequently happened? I understand you've tried to file for habeas corpus to try to get them to at least establish on the basis upon which they're holding him.
That's correct. Yes, that was done. This was Friday, June 8th. So it would have been Monday or Tuesday. I believe it was Tuesday, the following Tuesday. I didn't file the habeas corpus, but it was someone else took it up to Midland. The incident occurred in Redford, Michigan, which is in Wayne County, and they took him from there up about 100 miles north up to Midland. So we filed that habeas was filed with the Chief Justice of their circuit court in Midland. And we expected a hearing immediately on that. And he said, first he denied it, and then he said, well, he said, I will allow a motion to show cause, and then I will have a hearing on the motion on July 16th, which would be after the time where he would be released if he served the 30 days. So that ended that. Now we're filing another one. I guess it'll have to be Monday, tomorrow's Friday. Yeah, it would be tomorrow. Back up to Midland, there are two other judges up there, and we're going to file it with them. And that's supposed to get him a hearing.
Now, I understand one of the judges has made some comment about not allowing a filing that's not presented by a member of the bar.
I'm not aware of that, no.
Okay. So Trish, if she's able to come on for any length of time, may be able to share with us about that. What's the nature of these suits that David has filed against these judges?
Okay. If you read his biography, I did include that with the press release this time, and I did talk to David. David said, yes, please. Please include my biography. It's an 8-page document, but his background, he got involved in the court situation, and he got really, his whole life was turned around because of court. So he's been fighting this battle for quite some time. Well, as the time goes along, any time David doesn't get a fair shake in the court, which is almost every time, he files a lawsuit against the prosecutor, the judge, the police department. He goes after everybody. And in this particular case, the judge, Karen Khalil, K-H-A-L-I-L, I have it here in front of me. This is a filing that he did with the Michigan Judicial Tenure Commission. He's got about four or five judges that he's charging them with judicial misconduct and other things. But he's saying that she worked in concert along with numerous others of the Redford Township, inclusive of another judge, the Redford Police, District Attorney, the clerk, and the court administrator, and the county supervisor to intentionally misrepresent the nature of their hearings and to defraud the public. The modus operandi of this judge, in collaboration with other local government officials, is to send out police officers to write bogus tickets and then to have the very same police officer appear in court in place to come to court and to challenge the police citations. The same police officer to appear in court in place of the magistrate or judge to extort money from community citizens expecting to come to court to challenge the police citations. The notices are published in misleading fashion so as to have the public believe they will be appearing before a magistrate at a conference with the police representative. Anyway, sentencing can be expected. Upon arrival, they find instead the police officer dressed in plain clothes impersonating a district attorney at a desk offering plea deals of lower extortion amounts in exchange for admissions of guilt. Those who refuse, blah, 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 anyway, they're threatened, they're bullied, intimidated. But he also discovered that there was a bar number assigned to one of the agents there that was bogus too. There was no such bar number. So he went and did a little investigating, found out the whole system is corrupt, and this is what he does. He writes this up, and he files it and tries to get the courts to come clean and to be fair. As we know, convictions are what the courts are all about. It's not about justice. It's not about weighing the evidence. It's not about people getting fair trials. So anyway, the judge was sitting there, and she recognized him, and I think she just figured, well, let's put this guy away.
Red, I'd look for your feedback on this to start us out.
I am not familiar with the court system that they have, and this is in Michigan, am I right?
Yes, it was a district court.
Has he ever filed anything in federal court?
I believe he has attempted to file in federal court. He has not been able to get the courts to accept his filing.
I don't think you're going to get anything in the state or county courts any place. There might be some places where you would get something, but I know of a situation where a fellow got into one of these local municipal money traps. He was driving in another state other than where he lives, and he saw this roadblock ahead where they were checking trying to find some money for the city coffers. It was a city deal, and he saw it, and he just turned and drove into the parking lot of a business. And the cops just swarmed down on him, and they wrote him a ticket and hauled him off to jail, and he had to come up with a $750 cash bond to get out of jail. Mm-hmm. And he was somewhat knowledgeable in the courts and such, and he, you know, was trying his best to, you know, protect himself. And finally, they had him backed into a corner, and he had no place to go. And somebody told him he should call Red Beckman, and he did. And he told me the story, and I said, you should go to the nearest federal court and file a Title 42 1983 case as and under Rule 38. Rule 38 from the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. You won't find a lawyer hardly in the country. I've never found one that knows what Rule 38 is all about. And of course, they don't teach anything about the Seventh Amendment, the Seventh Article of the Bill of Rights. They don't teach that in law school because they've been doing everything they can to hide the Seventh Amendment. And without any question whatever, the Seventh Amendment is by far the most powerful and the most important of the 10 articles of the Bill of Rights. The Seventh is by far the most important. Now, this fellow, I told him, I said, file it in federal court against the city magistrate. I said, don't go against, don't file against the cops or the prosecutor, the city attorney. Just name the magistrate, the city judge on the tax court or the traffic court. And he did, and he had no place to go, and so he filed the action. When the judge was served the summons, he immediately, on his own motion, dismissed the charges against him. He told the city attorney to write the gentleman, the victim, an apology and notice him that the case had been dismissed. I don't know what all happened. I know the guy had blood in his eye. He was going after everything he could get. Now, what happens, I explained to him what happens. When the city traffic court judge, a magistrate, or whatever they wanted to call him, when he was served, he had to, the city fathers had to immediately alert the city, the insurance company with the liability insurance that the city has. And I right. got a hunch that it's probably the same in Michigan as it is in most places. Yeah. When that lawsuit is passed over to the insurance company, you're in a new ballpark completely. Right. It takes the city thieves masquerading as law enforcement and such. It takes them out of the picture. And I know that fellow collected pretty healthy amount, because the insurance companies don't care how much they have to pay. They want that lawsuit settled, and what they do is they just raise the premiums on the city to where they get their money back. It might take a little time, but eventually they get it back. And so this is something they need to take a look at up there in Michigan, because I have a suspicion that they do not understand what the Seventh Amendment is all about. And I can explain that if somebody gives me the time to do it, I'll explain why the Seventh is the one that we've got to bring back. We've got to make it, work. And I can assure you the legal profession and the judiciary, they don't want to hear about it. We have, I don't think we have lost a single case where we've used this in the tax court, the federal income tax court, because we cite the federal tax court judge. We cite them for their conflict of interest, and there's no argument. They can't argue out of it. They don't even try because they are, the court, they call it a court. It's not a court. There's no constitutional due process, no due process. It's strictly the judge makes all finding of fact and conclusions of law, and he's sitting there in his black dress and acting very pious and all that. But he is a criminal. And so I know that none of the cases that I've tried to help people, I know that not one of them ever went to trial and the cases were dismissed because those judges, they are very uncomfortable when you cite them for conflict of interest. So I'll turn it back to Terry.
Well, Red, I think we need to have a little more discussion about this, and I'm you're saying Title 42, Section 38, correct?
No. Well, it's Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, Rule 38. It's a Section 1983.
Right. Title 4, 1983 is deprivation of rights under color of law.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, the federal judge, when he sees that case, he recognizes that he, too, has to be very, very careful because he can be filed against with the same under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. I did this in 93 with the federal judge, and the case went up through the system and it was docketed with the U.S. Supreme Court in August of 96. In December of 96, the Solicitor General noticed all the parties to the action that he was not going to oppose me. This is so clear cut and so simple. I cited the judge, of course, for the Title 18, Sections 241, 242, and of course some others too, obstruction of justice, and of course I had noticed him of the 16th Amendment fraud. Back about 4 years before the book The Law That Never Was ever came out, because we already knew. We had the evidence that the 16th Amendment was a fraud that had never been properly ratified. And that judge, of course, he has gone to meet the great judge. I don't know where he is right now, but I wouldn't want to be in his shoes.
Well, and you did mention the Rule 38, and then in Article 7 it mentions common law court or common law. The suit said common law. That's another thing that we've been trying to do, is to get an Article 3 court so that our rights are respected and considered, and that's another issue that we've been trying to,
I wouldn't go any of those different things like that. You keep it very simple. Your complaint You make your complaint very, very short, and you reserve the right to amend that complaint at any time. This is common law, and if you want, I'll explain to you about the Seventh Amendment and what it really is.
Yeah,
David, you want to take the time right now to allow Red to do
sure,
that?
Sure. Yeah, I'm reading it, but I'm not getting probably not getting the meaning. I would like to hear what Red has to say about the Seventh Amendment. Yes.
Red, you have all the time you need.
If you just add things up a little bit, why don't they teach the Seventh Amendment in law school? I've never found an attorney that could even tell you much of any kind about the Seventh Amendment. And the reason is very clear, because the Seventh Amendment is common law, and common law attorneys cannot trespass on common law. Attorneys can't make any big bucks off of common law. Now, the common law, you see, the Seventh Amendment says that the findings of a trial jury cannot be reexamined by any court in the land. That's the part that gets to them and breaks their back. In other words, and I've bounced this off of a lot of attorneys in the last several years. In other words, the Seventh Amendment common law jury is the highest court in the land. The nine justices of the U.S. Supreme Court are just nine government agents. You cannot go to the U.S. Supreme Court and expect any kind of respect, whatever, for the simple as a pro per or whatever. You don't go that route. Because those people are all government employees. They have a conflict of interest. They cannot make a finding of fact or a conclusion of law. That stops the U.S. Supreme Court from interfering. It stops the district court judge from interfering. It stops the appellate courts from interfering in any way. When we went to the Ninth Circuit in that case back that I filed in 93, the Ninth Circuit, they said, well, this case belongs at the U.S. Supreme Court. And, of course, I knew that when I did it. But I also knew that I was going to be able to neutralize the U.S. Supreme Court because, now, this is the part that people just have a real hard time understanding. You see, up to 5 years ago, you didn't talk about sovereignty. You didn't have a state legislature in the country, I don't think, that even knew what the word sovereignty meant. Sovereignty is a major question today, and especially in state governments. And so the sovereignty issue, you see, back in the 80s, there was that patriot group in California. They started promoting sovereignty, and they contacted me and wanted me to become part of their game, and I asked them some questions. I said, well, how do you confirm, or how do you establish your common law, your sovereignty in the system? Where is it in the Constitution or Bill of Rights that establishes your sovereignty? And they couldn't tell me. They said, oh, you just have to declare yourself a sovereign. Well, I've seen that done too many times, and I've never seen anybody go any place with it. However, when you file a Seventh Amendment, a Title 30, or a Rule 38, Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, it provides for Seventh Amendment common law courts. Now, I was challenged back there 20 years ago on some of this, and I just brushed it off. I said, you know, you people, you don't want the little people out here to understand that they are kings and queens in their castles. It goes all the way back to Magna Carta. And Magna Carta, you know, it's really ironic because in 1215 A.D., they had a political system where the king said that he owned all the land, he had a divine right to be king, and the people had to pay a percentage of their productivity to the king. And the barons, some of the barons seen through that and decided something had to be done because King John was a tyrant. And so they wrote Magna Carta up to the point where they captured King John at the Battle of Runnymede and forced him to sign. Up to that point, King John had been at the top of the pecking order. Terry has gotten a pretty good handle on this pecking order thing because it's such a key to the whole thing. The King John was at the pecking order, top of the pecking order, and the people were at the bottom of the pecking order. When they got forced the king at the point of their swords to sign Magna Carta and come under Magna Carta, the people raised themselves up from the bottom and put themselves on top and put the king at the bottom. And this is what the Seventh Amendment does. It takes, when you go into that court, now, what's going to happen, what's already happening, tell you the truth, you will find that very few controversies. You see, this is basically controversies between the citizen as an individual and an agency of the federal government. I prefer to call it the federal god, small g. People, if they don't understand this sovereignty, what it means, that they're supposed to be at the top of the pecking order, you get into that court, and I'll guarantee you that judge sitting on the bench, that federal judge especially, he will recognize, he will know that he is on the bottom end of that pecking order, and the people are the ones that are on top of the pecking order. And he knows, and he cannot make a finding of fact or a conclusion of law in that controversy that is being, resolved right in front of him. Now, he sits on the bench. Yes, he sits there on the bench. He's got a job. And when he gets there in the morning, why, he unlocks the door and turns on the lights and adjusts the thermostat or whatever. And then he sits on the bench, and he is available if there's a question that comes up that needs to be asked. Now, one thing that happens with this common law, administrative procedures, administrative law in common law has absolutely no force. Every bit of it was put together by people with a conflict of interest because they were government. And you just brush all the administrative procedures, the administrative law, you brush it off the end of the desk and into the round pot, because this case, when you get that jury in there and you have the two sides, you're able to educate that jury. You're able to explain to that jury their responsibility. You're able to talk to them about the pecking order. All of that, and the judge can't say a word. He dare not interfere. And so that's in a nutshell. That's the basic principle that I'm talking about. The very fact that they don't teach it in law school, they don't want you to know about it. Back there, I remember way back there, at least 20 years ago, people said, oh, we don't have any common law courts yet. Well, if we don't have any common law courts, then we've got a major constitutional problem in this country. And so the Congress, when they wrote the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and all, they realized that there had to be, the Seventh Amendment calls for Seventh Amendment common law courts, and so they've got to make the provision for it. Those courtrooms belong to us. I've heard these judges saying, not in my court, this is my court. Every one of them belong in jail because they've tried to go way beyond their authority and such. The courtrooms belong to us, we the people. And so this is something that the Tea Party people need to really get a hold of. But so far, they're playing politics the old time way, and it's not a very good way to play, to do something for our country. So with that, I'll turn this back to Terry.
Well,
there'll be some more
questions,
I'm sure.
Well, I'm sure. And Trish is actually in our chat room. Trish, please call in. Dr. Kate has posted the number there, but 347-838-9176. Right now, we have Ed from area code 719 who has a question. Ed, you're live.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you doing this. I'd like to know if filing a Seventh Amendment case automatically makes it a common law.
Well, sure. Yeah, but you can't have an attorney, see? You cannot use an attorney.
Do you do a sui juris? Do you do a pro se?
You can have.
Wait
a minute. You can have an attorney sitting at your elbow. He can help you form questions and all, but if he stands up and say, "I'm representing so and so," you are done right there, because the judge is just hoping to goodness he can deal with an attorney. And then you got equity or admiralty jurisdiction.
Sure. Okay.
And so your questions are going to be simple. Nobody knows the controversy like you do.
Ed?
Yeah.
Ed,
okay.
If you go pro se, let me finish the answering your question
sure.
for you.
Yeah. Sure.
If you go pro se, then you are representing yourself and not there as yourself. So you've accomplished the same thing as having an attorney.
An attorney.
You
right.
have to be there. You have to be there pro persona, not representing anybody. You are there as yourself.
Yeah, that's very important. And of course the judge has to help you on that kind of thing. You see, When you go into that court and you're the sovereign and he's the servant, you can ask him questions, and he has to answer them.
Okay, if you wouldn't mind, Red, give me the site again. You said it's Title 43.
42.
42.
Title 42.
That's a Bivens style.
Okay. And you said it's under Rule 38 of the
Federal
FRCP?
Rules of Civil Procedure.
Okay.
What I did in that case where I sued the judge, I didn't understand it near what I do today. That was 93. And I've never said much about it. I've kept it rather just, I've just not, I didn't feel like I had anything to brag about. Of course, I thought that it would be settled, but now we find out that there are other cases that the Supreme Court has just hidden. You can't find them on the computer or anything, but I've never had that case dismissed. And so it's there, but they're not going to rule on it. The Supreme Court, they enjoy being at the top of the pecking order. And they like that. And they're all attorneys. And I think there's a special criteria to be a Supreme Court justice. I think you have to be, you know, very dishonest, very... politically, not constitutional in any way, because they tamper with the Constitution on a regular basis. So when you cite them for their conflict of interest, they're in trouble. And what I did when I filed that action, my complaint was very short. Couple of pages at all, and I've never shared that with anybody, and I never will, because if I was to write it today, it'd be different than it was then. But on your cover sheet on a lawsuit, you've got a column on the right hand side of the page, and
mm-hmm.
at the top you will have the judge's name and the case number. I put below that. Right in that column, I said, all facts to be tried by Seventh Amendment common law jury.
Very good.
It worked. It worked. There's been some cases over the years that have come out of the Supreme Court. Some people that know about this feel that the case has had a bearing on some cases, that the court knows that that lawsuit is there, and basically it's just hanging over their heads, and they've got to be scared to death of it. You see, our Article 3 of the Constitution basically tells us that they were to settle disputes between the states. And, of course, they are the ones that are going to get all the controversies between the corporations. Because the corporations are not common law, and they can't operate as common law entities because they are creatures that were created by government. And so they're not a creature created by our heavenly creator God. And that's the difference, a big, big, big difference. I'm convinced that the founders of this country, when they did the Bill of Rights, they made sure that number 7, that's God's number. God, 7 is his number. Now, let me back up a little bit here. Let's take a look at the First Amendment, the Fourth, and the Fifth. Those three are the darlings of the civil libertarians. You read all three of them. You read the first one. If there's a government agent that violates, and you are, or if they violate your rights and your damaged by their activity, where do you go for a remedy? There is nothing in the First Amendment giving any enforcement power whatever. You got to go to the Seventh. There's no enforcement power in the Fourth Amendment. There's no enforcement in the Fifth Amendment. And so, you see, the Seventh Amendment, it is, there's no question, it is the most important. I was a speaker at a Patriot meeting in the past. I can't travel anymore. But it was in the past, and the fellow that kind of headed it up had read my books and understood what I was saying. And there was about 40 people there, roughly, and they were pretty much all Patriot lawyer, you know, paralegal type of people. And when they came in, they gave each one of them a blank sheet, of a little slip of white paper, blank, and they told them to write on there which of the first 16 or I think it was 17 amendments to the Constitution that they felt were the most important. And when the meeting started, the MC, he collected the slips, and there were quite a few, of course, thought the first was the most important, and some thought the fourth, and others the fifth, and on down the line. Not one single one of them listed the Seventh Amendment as the most important one of all. And so when I got done explaining things over an hour, hour and a half, I asked the question, how many of you will agree with me that the Seventh Amendment is the most important of the 10 articles of the Bill of Rights? And everybody agreed with me. We're in a desperate situation in this country. We, of course, I am convinced that the federal God is going to go down. And because the first commandment is our Heavenly Father, he said, thou shalt have no other gods before me. And I went to the county library back in Montana and read all of the decision where the Supreme Court took the Bible out of the classroom in 1963. And there was a lot of verbiage there. I read every single word of it. And when I got done, I just said, well, what I'm reading there is they're saying, thou shalt have no other God before the federal God. And so they can put the picture of a pervert on the wall in the classroom, but they can't put a little placard up there with the Ten Commandments on it. And this is what brought down the USSR. It wasn't Reagan and his rebuilding our military and running up our debts. It wasn't that at all. It was our Heavenly Father brought the confusion on them to where they couldn't operate any longer, and they had to dissolve the USSR. And I'm convinced that the federal God here is going to be dissolved, and I don't think it's going to be too long before that happens. So I'm going to hang in there, and because I want to watch it happen.
Me too. Red, this is Dave Lonier again. What was the statement? The statement that you put under the judge's name and the case number and your filing.
I said all facts. All facts to be decided by Seventh Amendment common law jury.
Okay.
See, this judge, there had been three actions where I had filed by starting in 77. I filed these actions, demanded a jury trial, and on motion from the Justice Department, they motioned the judge to throw me out on a summary judgment, and the judge threw me out of court three times on three different actions, And that's where he got in trouble with Title 18, 241, 242, and some others, of course. But I had demanded a jury trial, and I was denied that. And I had no attorney on that. I was dumber than a stump when I started all this as far as in the courts. I knew we had a problem long, long before that, but that was when I really tangled with the Internal Revenue Service.
Well, Kate's been doing a little bit of research while we were talking, and she's posted a link to Cornell Education text for 42, Section 1983, Deprivation of Civil Rights. And one of the things that she's made comment to me about in our backroom chat is that it includes this Title 42, Section 1983, violation of civil rights. It includes a right to trial by jury.
So and if they deny you that, if they deny you that, and the judge signs the order denying you that, you got the prima facie evidence you need.
And does that matter whether you're in a federal court or not?
I would prefer the federal. I've never tried anything in the state court. You see, you got to remember that there's conflicts between the state courts and the federal courts. And sometimes I think that if you have a case where you've got a state or a county judge that's totally out of line, you know, constitutionally, you know, bad news, you're better off in federal court because they're a little more aware of the Constitution, the federal Constitution, than they are in the state courts.
Is there a state rule comparable to Rule 38 in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure? Would there be something in the state court rules?
There should be. I won't guarantee, but you see, every state is different. And so, you know, it would pay to check them out. But I like the idea of going to federal court, especially if it's like, you know, these municipals and such are so broke and they've got so many places to spend money and everything. They're running a lot of scams. They've doubled and tripled speeding tickets and all that kind of thing. And those highway patrol, they're just highwaymen out there collecting money for the state. And, you know, they really don't grasp how they're being used, I don't think. You know, the city council or your county commissioners or whatever, they'll raise those fines and they go out and they get, you know, they get some fines and they get a pat on the back.
That's right.
If they collect some money.
David Lonier, I'd like for you to comment at this point if you feel this is beneficial.
Oh well, I'm learning. I just pulled up Rule 38, and I see that is demand for a trial, right, trial by jury. What about David also requests a grand jury investigation into these in his court, you know, his complaints. Would that be something to be considered, too?
Well, the problem there, you see, is that every state is different. In Montana, where I've spent most of my life, of course, I've only known of one grand jury in my lifetime in the state because they just thumb their nose, the legal profession. So I don't know, but you see, you have a real problem because you end up with people that haven't got a clue what a grand jury is all about. So they get back, you know, the U.S. attorney or the district attorney or whatever, they put on a show, they're the nice guy and all this kind of thing, and the people on the grand jury are worthless. We had a case, it's 25 years ago, where the feds in Salt Lake, that's the IRS service center is there in one of the other cities right there. I can't remember, can't think of it right now. But anyway, they impaneled a federal grand jury, special federal grand jury, and they had seven or eight of the leadership of the freedom movement in Western U.S. And they had all of these guys targeted for criminal charges. And they spent a pile of money. And they subpoenaed people from all over the country, and they flew them into Salt Lake and one thing another. And there was two or three or four, I don't know how many people from Billings, Montana, where I was at the time, and they flew them down to Salt Lake and got their testimony. Well, one of the guys that was subpoenaed was a young guy, about mid-20s, and he had gone to a Patriot meeting in Phoenix. He was down there working on a construction job. And they had taken his license number off of his car or something, and they were able to identify him. And he came out to our house, and he was scared to death. He was shaking in his boots. And he didn't know anything about a grand jury. He knew about what I was saying, but he didn't really understand. And so he came out there, and I gave him somewhat of an education. And I gave him some books, and I gave him one of those, a copy of that tax audit guide, confidential IRS tax audit guide that was put out in 1975. And I gave him, highlighted some of the sections that he needed to have highlighted. And, of course, there was a couple of my books, and I gave him quite an assortment of material, and I told him, I said, now when they get you in that car, in that grand jury room, they're only going to ask one or two questions, and they're going to learn right quick that you don't know anything about this tax protest or anything else. And I said, they're going to shove you out the door. But I said, when they do that, I would hope that you would say, wait a minute. I want to talk to this grand jury. I didn't think he'd do it, but when it came to his turn to go into the grand jury, it worked out exactly like I told him, and they were going to haze him out of the room, and he said, wait a minute. I want to talk to this grand jury. And it threw such a curve at the prosecutor that he kind of stuttered a little bit, and he said, oh, well, that's up to the grand jury foreman. And the grand jury foreman, he'd gone in there with that armload of books. The grand jury foreman said, yes, we want to talk to him. And out the prosecutor went, and he had about 10 minutes. He could have taken more, but he was in over his head, and he knew it. I had told him, I said, now, if you get to do that, talk to them, you ask them if they would like to have this material, and you give them all of it. If they want it, you give it to them. And sure enough, it worked out just that way, and that grand jury sat for over a year and did not return any indictments whatever. That's what happens when people learn and get themselves informed. And, you know, I've been talking grand juries now for 40 years, and I'll tell you, it's been an uphill battle, and it's been real, real difficult.
Okay. Well, I do appreciate the information. You've certainly given us something to try, and it looks like, it looks good. I've been involved in, several federal cases where we use the 1983, but not in combination with the jury trial and the Seventh Amendment. So I really appreciate that.
Well, whatever you do, if you have a question, don't hesitate to call. Call Terry. He's got a lot of, he has soaked this up like a blotter. And I'm pinning a lot of hopes on Terry and Dr. Kate because they are two people that are very committed, and don't try to do this on your own. Like the tax court situation. Most of these people, they want to email me their paperwork, and it gives me an opportunity to kind of see what their progress is and give them a clue or two. And so I'll be more than happy, if possible, to give you a hand. I'm on a day-to-day basis. I just had four hospitalizations in 5 months and probably more coming up. So don't let that bother you, because this is some of the most important work I've ever done in my life, and so I'll do everything I can to help you.
Appreciate that very much.
David, I understand that this judge was actually one of the judges that has been named in one of David Scheid's cases. Is that true?
At least one case. Plus, he's also filed a judicial tenure commission complaint.
That being the case, why would there not be a good move to move that this judge is incapable of making an impartial decision related to David because the judge is a named defendant and thereby should recuse themselves?
Absolutely. I agree. Yep. I didn't draw up the writ or the appeal, so I'm not, I don't know whether that was included, but that's been certainly discussed, that she would have a conflict of interest and be motivated, to take retaliation against him. I don't know whether, but that would be something that should be addressed. I agree.
He should be well paid for every day in jail.
We understand that. I think there's some law that for false imprisonment where they're entitled to compensation for their time.
Well, David, where would you like to see this conversation go tonight? We've talked about this for a little over an hour, and we've got about 50 more minutes here to go on the show, and we're really kind of open tonight as to what we talk about. I appreciate the work that you're doing, and especially what's going on with David Scheid, and want to bring this out. I wish Trish would call in. She's been in our chat room and been watching some of the comments she's been making in our chat room regarding to filing the habeas corpus. But I'm thinking that these filings could be, could have some more teeth if some of these other tactics were employed, particularly declaring that judge to be a government agent, and not only a government agent, but prejudiced particularly toward David Scheid because of being named as a defendant. And I think that there's a lot of potential here for what Red's talking about in the midst of this action.
Well, I agree. The question is, you know, I'm not totally in the loop as far as writing the complaints. So I'm not, you know, I don't, but I don't know. I definitely agree that she should be cited for conflict of interest. Whether that was in the pleading or not, I don't know. And then the other question is where we've all been discussing this. Where is the best venue to file these documents? And, you know, everybody's back and forth. Is it the township? Is it the county where the incident occurred? Is it where he's incarcerated? Is it state? Is it federal? You know, these are all questions that nobody seems to have a concrete answer for.
Well, I believe you've gotten some clues from what Red has said, and the fact that this judge is acting really outside of the scope of being a public servant, which I recognize they've been taking off of those lists in most states, and they're really not – they don't even classify them that anymore. But the fact that they are a government agent and not capable of making an impartial decision – seems to be justification for taking this to the federal level. The fact that you can demonstrate in this case that this judge is acting out of political reasons and also for personal reasons because of being named as a defendant in a case filed by David, it seems that alone would justify that he is now being damaged by a judge and could file that in federal court against that district court judge.
I agree.
Let me add a couple of words here. And I would recommend that you file it just against the judge. Don't file it against any of the other people because you want to call them as witnesses.
Uh-huh.
You can file actions against them later after they have testified under oath. And then you've got that kind of evidence, you see, about their input on this thing and how come they're in it too. But let me back up just a little bit here. I think that your chance of getting it into a federal court with an actual Seventh Amendment trial are very, very, very slim. Because when that case is turned over to the insurance company attorneys, it won't take them very long. They'll know exactly what you've got and what, they don't want to go into court and try to defend that judge. Not when that judge has been cited for conflict of interest and such. And they'll pay off. I mean, they are the ones who decide how that case comes out. So they're going to want to settle that case. It won't. I would almost bet, lay your odds that it won't go to trial because they can't risk it. The insurance company, it's just. I've seen a number of these now, and I haven't seen one of them that ever went to trial. So
should. We determine who the insurer is or the bond people and then make sure they get a copy of the complaint.
How's that again?
Will the insurance, the people who insure these judges or these townships, will they be notified by the court or should the...
The city.
The city,
they are the ones that their insurance company, their liability insurance,
they will know.
What?
They will know that they will know that there's an action been filed against this judge, right?
Yeah, as soon as that judge is served, why, he'll notice the city fathers. There'll be some pretty frantic phone calling, and the prosecutor and the city fathers and everybody, but they've got to notify the liability insurance company. I think it's that way in every single state.
I'm quite sure you're right.
Yeah. And so, like I said, you see, the insurance company, they don't really care that much about how expensive it is, how much it costs them to settle this, because they just raise the premiums, and they get it all back, and, you know, over a period of time, they get it all back.
Right, right. Puts more money in their pockets.
Sure.
Okay.
Dwayne, do you have anything to contribute at this point?
Well, I know that David and I go back several years, good many years actually, and I think that he's probably stirring, wishing that he could be on the outside putting this together for us, and he's pretty good with most of what we're learning here. I don't know that David's on board with the Seventh Amendment, so I think this will be a big sword in their fortress, their armament, I guess to say. And I saw that David Lonier here has a good background with all of this as well. I think he'll be able to put this together and maybe make this work. I do know that whenever my texts back and forth with David quit coming a couple weeks ago, I wondered what happened to David. And of course, the following day, I get this message that he was hauled off. I think that I was caught by surprise with it, and so were quite a few of his friends. But with the knowledge that Red has just passed on to Mr. Lonier here, I think they've got some great new weaponry in their arsenal. And I'd like to see that that get into action, actually. But I don't know. It's an interesting picture. I'd like to see everybody. As always, the nation's most hated preacher. I'd like to see everybody repent before we work on this any deeper. But exactly what I see here is a lot of us are working diligently to try to get guys like David's support. Because I heard what happened to Schaefer this week. You guys might not be aware of. He and his friends were convicted this week. I just got that myself this afternoon.
Dwayne,
yes.
we saw in William Miller's case that the pressure from other local politicians, you know, had its effect to get him out and to get them off of his case from harassing him without cause. Is anything like that being applied in David Scheid's case in Michigan? So I guess that's a question for David Lonier.
Yes.
Are there any local politicians?
That's where I was actually headed, and they have to answer that. And that's exactly where I was headed. With Schaefer's situation, he has lost the team that he had that was very much like ours that we have here. And I think that's why Schaefer did not have the success we are having. And there's a long story behind that, too. We can get Dave Bartels on to tell us that one if you'd like to find it. Yeah, David, if you could answer that for us, that's where I was heading anyway.
We have informed a number of people, some of our local politicians, and two candidates for judge, local candidates. In fact, one of them read, one of the newspapers published my release, so he was aware of it, and they agree that, you know, based on the facts as we presented them, that David was falsely arrested and incarcerated. So, yeah, we're trying to work with people in the political arena and the judicial arena and attorneys too. One of the county commissioners is an attorney, and he's very much he's sympathetic to the what's going on. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, a little bit. But are they doing anything about it? Are they questioning this judge? Is anybody from the Congress or local politicians actually making contact with that judge to say, hey, what is going on here? Why are you doing this to this man, especially in a situation where, you know, you're a named defendant in a case with him?
Nobody's taken up the cause, no. Nobody that would have political, clout has done that, no. That's why we're trying, as best we can to get the word out to let people know what's going on. And I will be able to work with David on this Seventh Amendment issue in the Rule 38. And I do like the idea. At some point, we will probably be using this strategy. And when we do, I will definitely let you know how it goes. But yeah, we need help from as many as many people as possible. That's true.
Well, if anyone else would like to call in and ask a question or make a comment at this point, our phone lines are open, and Dr. Kate, our very kind and generous producer, is watching our switchboard, and we would certainly welcome anyone to call in at this point. We've got about another half hour, a little over half hour to go, and would welcome the questions. 347-838-9176 is our call in line. Just hit a 1 to ask. It raises your hand and lets us know you'd like to speak to us. Red, I think at this point we could use any other wisdom that you've got related to how to put pressure on these judges. This is the big key, and what I'm hearing you say is that the case probably will never be heard if you file it in federal court, because what it does is it puts enough pressure on the judges that they decide at that point, time to dismiss this case. That's what I'm hearing you say, basically.
Yes, by all means. And of course, when you go to the law library and start checking the law books, you won't find any common law actions, that are recorded there. They don't want this kind of information out. And you see, we've got a lifetime of mental assault against us. Thinking that we've got to have an attorney to do anything in the courts. And boy, I'll tell you, it's hard to get over that and get past that to where we start thinking about what it means to be king and queens in our American Republic. It just takes some... It takes some real mental gymnastics to get rid of all the garbage that's been planted in our lives, in the schools, in the media, in our churches. Don't expect any help out of the churches. I'll guarantee you that. That's no place to go for help. I hope these people will, take a good look at this thing. And, the Seventh Amendment is that's where we have our sovereignty is confirmed. And, boy, I'll tell you, we need a lot of people in this country that recognize what it means to be sovereign, that you have to accept the responsibility of leadership, not followership, not membership or anything else. You've got to be leadership, and you do it on an individual basis. It's not something you do only if you've got a crowd with you. You stand up and be counted as yourself. And I know that this is being, I know it's being, brought out now because of the sorry state of affairs in our courts and such, and there had to be something there that we could hang our hat on and say, hey, this is going to stop. The founders weren't, they didn't make very many mistakes. They knew what would happen. They had studied history. They knew that the government would try to get the pecking order and control of the pecking order from the top. And, of course, the Roe v. Wade decision, and, of course, the one I mentioned, the Bible out of the classroom. They took the prayer out of the classroom in 1948 or 47. I don't remember which now.
There's nothing you're talking about here?
What?
Trish, you have a live mic, and Red was finishing his comment, so we're hearing you now.
Okay.
Go ahead, Red.
Well, I kind of lost my place there a little bit. What was the – who was it trying to call?
This is Trish. She is the one that is – that is trying to write up, and she's no attorney. She's, just a layperson, and she's trying to write up the habeas corpuses on behalf of David Scheid.
I wouldn't waste 5 minutes with the habeas corpus.
I'm just trying to do what I was asked to do.
I understand that. But they have the legal profession has pretty much killed the habeas corpus effectiveness in this country. Between the lawyers, the legal profession, and the judges who are lawyers as well, they thumb their nose at habeas corpus anymore. I've seen it happen too many times, and. It takes such a little effort. In fact, it'll take less effort to file a complaint in federal court than it will doing a habeas corpus. Title 42 complaint under the Seventh Amendment. Rule 38 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure.
Trish, David Scheid requested that you do this.
Yes, and I've also been instructed by somebody that Dave Monier was speaking of that is running for the clerk for Traverse City, who is compassionate and understands what's going on with retaliation from this 17th District Judicial Judge Khalil in Redford Charter Township. And she instructed me that when we filed the writ of habeas corpus, in Midland County, the county where he's detained, we did it incorrectly by citing the wrong Michigan court record rule. She instructed me to go and resubmit the writ of habeas corpus under the Michigan court rule 3.303F11A. And where that is basically because he was, like I had pasted within the chat box, what has been requested that I record by using the MCRZ 3.303F11, I need to base the writ solely on the violation of the laws that she had done, trying not to focus the attention on the retaliation due to the Michigan Supreme Court case that is pending right now, as well as the two in the Circuit Court of Appeals that need to be now placed in the Michigan Supreme Court. Also, the active court case that's in the Wayne County Circuit Court, all naming the specific judge in her fraud and criminal corruption. So what I was instructed to do, going back to what I was circling back around, is that I need to state that because I'm constructing the writ of habeas corpus pretty much as we speak, that I'm using the validity of that MCR to use in the writ by, you know, without providing any effective assistance or a hearing, without the ability to inquire on the cause of the detention or the existing procedures employed by the 17th District that are arbitrary and capricious, applying erroneous descriptions of the conduct of the underlying offense in violation of David Scheid's 1st, 6th, and 14th Amendment, also by using the possibility of the avenue of the ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act. David Scheid has a recorded hearing loss subsequently that he needs to be using a hearing aid that he was not using the date that that is in question. And he has been diagnosed, as I said, since childhood. So in regards to the writ, I've included that information, but I was told to keep it short. And what I was going to do after I ended with that is I was going to add his David's affidavit, his statement / crime report, which I've posted publicly once, but to use that as the sole testimony to what is transcribing right now. And the reason to do that is to see about releasing him from this prison tomorrow. If I make it and do this writ of habeas corpus and file it as instructed by the woman in Traverse City running for the county clerk of Traverse City, that I need to file A with Jonathan Latterbach or something like that. I need to file it with the chief judge. I've also located, thanks to Dave Lonier, another chief judge that's in the 42nd Judicial Circuit is John Hart. And then we had located a third judge because this has to be filed in with three judges within the county where he's incarcerated at, not the county where the offense took place, because the sheriff, Jerry Nielsen, that presides in the Midland County Sheriff, we need to direct it to him because now it falls into his lap because now the offense trickles into that county as of what resulted from Wayne County's 17th Circuit Court. Now, if I use a short outline of the writ of habeas corpus I constructed along with the affidavit or crime report, I also need to make sure that I state the confinement order that was never even presented to David Scheid. Also, I need to take with me and attach to the writ and the affidavit for crime report an order for release. So if I take it to these three judges, then if they take it and they accept it, they therefore have at their fingertips without looking for it, have the order of release where they can accept it and release him in the same document. Now, with that being said, without going down any rabbit holes that I can't afford to do right now, being common law and grand juries, we don't have the time for that. That's got to come at a later date. If all three of these judges find in favor of the 17th Judicial Court ruling, they become liable as well. So if they do deny it, therefore it can automatically be taken into federal court, which Dave Lonier has already started drafting that U.S. District Court filing right now. So we've got the bones of it put together with all the affidavits of everybody involved, including his statement of indigency, well, his state of remember the word.
Properous.
Properous, but his state of financial stress that he's under, because I have all the originals of everything to file with that. I'm going to file that with the writ of habeas corpus just to show that he is financially unable to pursue anything else right now other than us trying to get him out. So if they all deny, which it's highly unlikely that all three of these judges will deny it, because then they all now have signed fault for what Judge Khalil has done in the 17th District. I'm open to any suggestions. So if I do a short writ and then do the order of release and submit his affidavit, I was told that should be adequate, and then I take it directly to the judge's chamber in each of these courts and present it directly to the judge or to the clerk if they're holding court at that time, hand it to the clerk, sit down, and wait for them to call, because they will call it immediately, is what I'm told. Is anybody experiencing
David
Scheid
has... David Scheid at this point has no ability to write or submit any of this himself?
No, he cannot. We did the original writ, and we sent it to him with for also a Wayne County writ of habeas corpus, along with an appeal as of right and a demand for a bond hearing, and he is not allowed to do anything. He's allowed to accept the documents, but he's not allowed to sign the documents when we went and seen him. Now, but in regards to the writs that are going to these three judges tomorrow in Midland County, this is something that I was told that I should do in my own name to expedite this, in case the fact that if I do mail it to him, he's got to take it there. He's got to wait a few days to get it notarized. He's got to wait a few days before that he can even get the envelope to send it in. And then they wait a few days to mail it, you see. And then if we do a show cause, like what happened in the first writ that was submitted incorrectly, then that means that they did offer the show cause, but it is offered in regards to the 16th of July after he's gone. So I need to remove the option, and there is no show cause at all that is even listed in this new writ, because we don't want to give them the option to do a show cause if it's going to happen a month down the road, because we need to get him out tomorrow. That's the goal.
So, Red, does that make it a little clearer for you that she has, what she's taken on at Mr. Scheid's request?
Well, totally, she's putting a lot of work into it, and I'll tell you, if it works, fine. My goodness, get him out where you can then file the action for damages, you see.
Right. We are going to file civil rights on this. He's going to open a civil rights case, and we need to get a large law firm that it will take this on a contingency basis at this point. And like
See, Trish, that's what Red's trying to Red's trying to tell you. That's the wrong way to go.
Well, I just don't like lawyers, and I don't like the way they operate. But of course, you see, as outrageous as this is, I can see why a big civil rights law firm would be more than happy to take it, because you see, they'll work with the city liability insurance and all, and they'll want so much more money than if the common law thing goes through. So, you know, you're on your own there, and I just admire you. My hat is off to you, because I can tell you've been putting a lot of work into this thing, and I hate to say it, but I'll tell you, these habeas corpus things are just about as dead as can be, but I hope, of course, that it could still be effective in Michigan. I know where in a lot of places it doesn't get you any place, but what you do end up with is some signed documents, signed by a judge or somebody, and of course, then you've got the prima facie evidence a violation of civil rights. I like those documents signed by judges.
Trish, are you still with us?
I'm right here. I'm also including that David Scheid thereafter was illegally arrested by Rutherford Township Police in the courtroom of Judge Karen Kaleo for alleged never revealed civil or criminal contempt of court under the police authority and illegally transported to the Midland County Jail in Midland, Michigan to serve 30-day criminal sentence under the Michigan statute of MCLA 600.1701 without being formally arraigned on the said unfound charge. Never revealed criminal or civil or a court in Michigan of law or affordable reasonable bail bond as provided by the Michigan law. And then I use the Michigan Constitution, Article 1, Section 15 in 1963, and then naturally a case law attached to that. Because I want to stick with direct facts what led up to this, because his statement that is going to be presented is going to state the retaliation of what she did, because David Scheid was looking down at the time that she was screaming at Molman to state his name into a microphone when he would not submit to the straw man. Now, when that happened, she knew what he was going to do and immediately put him in the jury box. Guess what? That threw him into the de facto, for lack of a better term. And when David Scheid was taking notes, she's hollering at the guy to stand up and then to sit down in the chair and then stand up and then sit down in another chair and then stand up. Meanwhile, David Scheid is taking notes without a hearing aid, hearing this person to sit down, stand up. At that time, during these notes, she's saying the same thing to him but not addressing him by name. So therefore, she is hollering at David Scheid when he's looking down, writing on a piece of paper. And then next thing you know, he hears a male voice right in front of him, screaming at him to stand up. He complied. He stood up. Two bail bondsmen, bailiffs, officers, police, whatever, walked over to the door to seal the courtroom. And when he looked over there, he heard a male voice saying, "Sit down." He sat down thinking it was the man in front of him. When he sat down, he heard "stand up." He looked up. He stood up. They grabbed him, took him into a lockdown room, and that's the rest we know of it. The court watchers stayed in that courtroom until everything was over. They were told, these court watchers, that he is going to be brought up in front of the judge because they were going to stay there for this. They stayed for the duration of that day, of the proceedings. They were told that it's over. They left. I got there. I went immediately to the court. They would not allow me in the building. I went to the police station. They told me that I couldn't converse with him because I'm not a bar card holding member. So what I told him is, all right, so that means I'm not a member of the club, so therefore I can't communicate him as a liaison between him and his minor son. He said, "Well, you want me to call the friend of the court?" I'm like, what's wrong with your head? What are you thinking? So I'm like, all right, no worries, I'm leaving. So when somebody was listening to the officer at the front desk, he leans over as I grab the front door to push it open. He said, "Hang on a second." He hollered to me that he's being held on a civil infraction, contempt of court, 30 days, no bail, no bond, quote, unquote. That's what I was told. So I'm like, well, I got to go back over to the court because I've got court watchers over there. Because remind you, they didn't allow me in the court building at all. So I go back over there and because they wanted me to tell his name. And I said, well, I think this is part of what the issue is. And they're like, well, I have court watchers here. They said, you cannot come in this courtroom, this court building. The courtrooms are locked. It's over. When I walked into that room, that building, I remembered as I walked in, the judge and her minions were walking out. So therefore, I didn't realize that connection until an hour later. And then when I walked out, I immediately called one of the court watchers. And I said, where's everybody at? They won't let me in the court. And nobody knew what was going on at that point. So either did David Scheid at that point. He was handed a piece of paper that he could not even hold, let alone read, because he didn't have his reading glasses on. So he didn't know what he was being tried. He never went in front of a judge for a trial or hearing or anything. They took him. They told me when at the jail, when I was walking out the door, after they said that he's being held without bail, without bond for 30 days, they said that he'll be in the Clinton County Correctional Facility. I'm like, okay. The next morning, I call there. He's not here. I call the court. They said, well, he went, try Midland. I tried Midland. They said he's there. That's where they go for the overflow. So that's how we found out he was there. He got transported there without them even, him even knowing what he was being held for. At that point, as far as he knew, he was being kidnapped. Through retaliation, when the court was being heard prior to all of this, in the moment case being called up, he went to the washroom. The minute he walked back in the courtroom, the judge seen him, her eyes followed him, recognized him, he sat down. She immediately called the moment case up, started the fiasco, never swore him in. The moment guy, he was never sworn in. This case was never sworn in. Under a court of law. And when David Scheid, when the writ was filed the next day in Midland, there was no case record of him in existence. The person that submitted the writ of habeas corpus demanded that they get a case number. And if the case number is now cited with the writ of habeas corpus as the case number. Which is good for our point, because now we're resubmitting the writ to the same chief judge and one other chief judge and another judge in that county. Because somebody has to address this. So if that's
well, Trish, I see why David Scheid is relying on you, because you have a memory and a mind like a steel trap. So I very much appreciate your attention to the detail that's going on here.
So that's why I think that the writ has to be focused solely on what exactly he was deprived of by using that specific. I guess when you were talking about, somebody was talking about how the writs don't work, and I was told why that writ didn't work, because we used the wrong writ number. I guess the MCR number. She told me only to use this specific one. Write it down. Don't forget it, Trish. This is the one you're basing it on. Don't use the other ones. Use only this one. So that's the only one I'm citing. I've removed all of the other ones, all of the jargon that says, you know, everything that happened, because that's an appeal of a right case where that's all explained in there. So right now I'm going to use that writ number, the hearing loss. I'm using the Michigan Constitution, Article 1, Section 15, on the no bail, no bond violation. And I'm also going to use the Michigan statute on being held without formally being arraigned. Because he was never formally arraigned or had a hearing on the sentence. And now it's a criminal offense that he never even knew. So we've got to hang our hats on specific things she said. I don't know.
Well, and that also sets you up for the follow-up suit once you've got him out.
Right. I also want to use it was never revealed that criminal or civil contempt of court was a violation of his legal and constitutional rights that guarantee under the Michigan law. See Madness versus Myers. I'm trying to stick with certain ones, you know. I don't know. I'm just trying to do what I can do to help this poor guy. I want him to have his dog back. We fixed his air conditioning.
Ha, ha, ha. Red, we've got about 10 minutes. Any final comments?
Well, I'm glad there's people out there all across the country, every place you go. You've got people that are researching, they're studying the Constitution, and they're trying to get answers. And it's got everybody in Washington, D.C., pretty nervous. That's why they're passing some of this crazy law. What is it, the NDAA or something that they passed? And it's so outrageous. And we don't want to forget the spiritual aspect of this. Satan is a destroyer, and he is not a creator, and he is running loose in this country right now, and the judiciary is it's just an extension of Lucifer and his army of thugs that he uses. So I'm going to have to drop off here. I've got some pressing things happening right now, so I'm going to have to go. But I wish them the best, and if they get this habeas corpus and get him out, fine. I just say get it done, and then file your Title 42, because
right.
you can collect, and because this is one of the most atrocious things I've ever heard, and I've heard some pretty bad ones. And so you've got the Seventh Amendment is just waiting to be used. So I thank everybody for calling in and making this a very interesting program. And I'm going to leave a little early here. So I
thank you.
Wish you the best.
Thank you, Red. Thank you, Red. God bless you, brother.
Thank you. Thank you. Can I say something?
You certainly may.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that word is really getting out, and as Red mentioned, people are waking up and learning about this particular case. I got a call today from Bob Schultz, and Trish and I are both. Next time we talk to David, he can only call us; we can't call him. Bob wanted him to give him a call because Bob's very concerned too.
And if I can just say something in closing. That just reminds me today of a Gandhi's famous quote about evil, history, inspiration, and truth. Remember that all through history, the way of truth has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for all that they seem invincible, but at the end, they always fail. Think of it, always. The murderers and tyrants always fail, and truth always prevails. And I'm taking that one to the bank and getting gold with it, of course.
Thank you, Trish.
We obviously agree with that, and I will reserve my comments on some other things that we were just that David Lonier was just talking about. I'd kind of like to have a private conversation because I prefer not to say certain things. In a public venue, and there are a couple of things here that I would like to throw some warning flags up for you on. So I'll preserve that for after we get off the air. But I really appreciate you guys, both of you coming on, and Trish, especially with you trying to write this up tonight. I hope that just sharing it's been able to help you think through some of this without having to get specific feedback. But if you do need some more feedback on what you're doing tonight, obviously I'm not an attorney. I've got one that's a very good one that I use as counsel. In other words, the person to my elbow that is also a sovereign and a patriot and does lectures on being sovereign. So he understands where we're coming from with the Seventh Amendment and stuff. So I can certainly pass this by them. Kate, did you have any final comment, or Dwayne, either one of you, in the last 5 minutes we've got here? Dwayne, do you have any closing comment to make?
Well, I can always ramble on something, but in this case, I think that what I'd like to get across is with David Scheid, he and I, and of course, how many others of us around the nation that, like Red just said, we're all studying this, we're all sinking our teeth back into the truth of all this, trying to figure out how to solve this. It is a critical understanding to know what your enemy is doing. So even though I would always say, you know, it's not up to the victim to follow the criminal's rules, as I coined that phrase a long while back, but we do at the same time have to know what they're up to. What David and Trish are doing here tonight, among other friends that they have as well. I mean, Dave Scheid has a lot of friends up there in Michigan. I've talked to quite a few of them. I could mention some more names that I'm sure are on that same team that I've known over the years. But I know that quite a few of us are learning something, which is no matter how much we might want to give credit to our own ingenuity, the real truth that brings the light to all of these situations almost always inadvertently comes from the Bible. We might say, I thought of it, but, well, you know, it originally was in the Scriptures. Truth has only one source, and I think that as we're starting to learn all these things, a lot of us, including myself years ago when I started this battle, fighting this beast system, I found out that everything I had in my heart, everything I wanted to look forward to bring true justice out there, I found that the real answers always came from the Bible. If it didn't seem to fit at first, I thought about it, and it fit later. And for David and Trish, I'm behind you for David's case here. Otherwise, we wouldn't have brought them here to Terry and Red's show. But I'm here with you guys for the rest of the duration on this. If there's anything I would like to have sent to David Scheid in the prison, if you could pass it on, is that I'm praying for him and hoping that, and I know David will receive that well because David and I talked about that quite a few times. But that I want to wrap up here real quick, let Terry finish this up, and it's just, I am with you guys. If there's more I can do, just give me a call. Love you both.
Thank you, Dwayne. And David Lonier, we've got about 3 minutes. I'm going to let you close this one out with anything you'd like to say.
Well, I just want to say I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you tonight and to promote the issue and get it out there so people understand what it is. And I think talking it over helps us, proceed and see what we can do. And I really, really appreciate what Trish is doing. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. And let's. I think we should probably go with the habeas. Let's get it out there. Let's get it filed and let's see what happens. Go from there. That's about all I have. Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us, Trish. Are you still with us?
I'm here. Oh wow!
You're a trooper. You are a trooper, and I hope you get some sleep tonight. And I'm not trying.
I don't think that's going to happen. I got to figure out how to do this.
You have my email. I'm sure you got that on our private chat in the chat window. And
I think I just closed it out. I just closed it out.
Okay. Would you like for me to put it back in there for you, or?
Yeah. Yes, please.
All right, I will do that. And thank you so much for taking your time tonight. I know you're under a lot of pressure tonight, and I hope you'll stay in touch with us, and hope you'll come back and give us a report next week. And I'm hoping that David
will be giving his report next week, not me.
That's what I was hoping.
Right.
Thank
well, God
you.
Bless you all. Dwayne, we got a minute and a half. Close us out in prayer, will you, brother?
I'll be happy to. Thanks, Terry. Oh, Heavenly King, our wondrous, gracious King, as I said earlier, the great lawgiver, he who seems to have so much information that It always amazes me why I didn't see his truth when I was younger and took me so long. Of course, we all have to fall down sometimes, don't we, Father? He teaches us to fall down so that we could look to him to be picked back up. And as a nation, it works as it does with individuals. We have to fall down sometimes pretty hard before we pick ourselves back up and face him. Father, we thank you for this opportunity that you will allow us to face you one more time. And we want to humbly seek your face, and we want to seek your wisdom, your truth, that you might direct us in which way to go. Father, you've shown me so many things, the lies that are all around us. I mean, even the lie of evolution, finding out that they commissioned that complete situation. Father, you've shown us so many things. Continue to show us what you would have us do, and that you would keep David and his heart and his soul at peace while he's in there. We ask these things in the name of your Son, Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus the Christ. With all glory to you, Father, your coming kingdom, which we look forward to tonight. Hallelujah and amen.
Amen. And we pray for God's hand to be on David Scheid. I understand he's been a little bit on a hunger strike sometimes. We haven't talked about that, but I've also heard that they're giving him peanut butter and he's allergic. So we pray for David Scheid. God bless you all. See you next week on Walls in Our Minds.
Thank you.
What if his people